Welcome, everybody. Welcome to The Past is Unpredictable, South African History and the Understanding of the Constitution. My name is Claire Kelly, and I'm one of the coordinating team here at Summer School. Summer School has offered a number of courses on the Constitution over the last few years, but this one is unique in its approach and content. And it is my pleasure to introduce to you Professor Penn Ross, who has not spoken at Summer School before, but with whom many of you will be familiar through his blog, Constitutionally Speaking, which I consult probably on a daily basis, and also through his numerous television, radio, and appearances, and his work in the print media. So Peter Voss is the Claude Leon Foundation Chair in Constitutional Governance in the Department of Public Law here at UCT. He also served as Deputy Dean 2010 to 2013. He teaches in the area of constitutional law and human rights, and has published widely on issues of social justice and sexual orientation and racial discrimination. He serves on the boards of several NGOs, including the AIDS Legal Network and the Triangle Project, and also regularly makes submissions to Parliament to advise and comment on draft legislation. In 1994, and I did not know this about you, he published a novel in Afrikaans called Slits, Blancas, Whites Only, about a young Afrikaans man coming to grips with his policeman father's involvement in apartheid death squads. So look out for that. I don't know, is it widely available? But also look out for a forthcoming textbook to be published by Oxford University Press in February, so next month, next week in fact, called Constitutional Law in Context, which is co-edited and co-authored by Professor De Vos. We are extremely lucky to have him here with us today, to give us insight into, among other things, how the court's understanding of South African history can determine how various human rights are interpreted. Please welcome Professor Pedros.
Thank you, Claire. I don't have a PowerPoint because I hate the PowerPoint. I feel that it sucks the air out of the room and nobody's going to look at me. So if I was speaking fast, you can just tell me and then I'll try and speak more slowly. Now what I will do in the next 3 days, talk really about one way in which the Constitutional Court tries to interpret the Constitution through the lens of history. And obviously I'm going to do it with reference specifically to one section of the Constitution, Section 9, which guarantees the right to equality but also requires redress measures, affirmative action, whatever you want to call it, to be taken. So that is what I'm going to do today. I will set the scene by talking about the court, why it refers to history, how it does so, and whether there are maybe some problems with this issue, and whether it is so easy to say you just look at the past and the history and then you can interpret the Constitution in that way. So that is what I want to do. I want to start by quoting from a judgment of the Constitutional Court, which perfectly illustrates how the court uses history in order to understand what the rights might mean. And that is a judgment, a very recent judgment of November 2013 in Geithner and others versus the Minister of Finance and others. And that case actually dealt with searches and seizures. The right to privacy, Section 14 of the Constitution says that you have a right to privacy, including a right not to have your home and your person searched. Now, what does that mean? Because obviously we do know that the police can search you. And where are the limits in this? And the court had to decide that. So the opening paragraph of its judgment in that case read as follows. And now I must put on my glasses because I'm getting old. I can't read it anymore. Kobungo is the warning that the lookout would sound on the arrival of the police at one or the other of the homes that have the misfortune of being subjected to frequent warrantless police searches. To the apartheid state, the oppressed majority had no privacy to be protected and no dignity to be respected. Of course, the warning could only be sounded on some of those occasions when the police descended for the searches during the day. Most certainly, for effect and possibly heightened indignity, many of the egregious searches were conducted at the dead of night, a time of relaxation, sleep, intimacy, reckless abandon even, and when some, if not most, would be flimsily dressed. The sense of violation and degradation that the victims must have experienced is manifest. And that word, kubumvo, is then put in a footnote, explained that in the Nguni languages, it is a word like, it is red, but it can also mean it's hot, things are happening, something like that. And the court then goes on in this judgment to say, given that history of how people's dignity were taken away from them through these completely unannounced searches and seizures of especially black people in South Africa, you have to give them the words and the understanding of what Section 14 means. You have to interpret it in that context. So I'm just putting that out there as almost as a preamble to what I'm going to say. So the question will first arise, why would the court have to do that? Because we have a Bill of Rights, say if we talk about the Bill of Rights, and that Bill of Rights contains a whole set of relatively detailed rights enunciated in it. Surely some people will argue, all you have to do is to look at the rights, to say what the text of the right says, and then you know what the answer is, what the scope of the right is, what the duties of the state might be, and so on. But it doesn't really work that way. And the reason for that is that constitutions, especially bills of rights, are written in relatively general language. It doesn't actually give you answers to real-life constitutional law problems directly. So I would give you a few examples. Section 10 of the Constitution says, everyone has the right to have their dignity respected and protected. It's a beautiful sentence, but what the hell does it mean? Our Constitutional Court, in a famous judgment in the Darwin case, said it actually means, amongst other things, that you have the right to get married and to live with the partner of your choice in a marriage. That's not written down there. They had to invent it in a way by interpreting the text, because the text is open-ended. You can say the same thing about the section that talks about freedom of expression, that everybody has a right to freedom of expression. Now, what do we mean by expression? Is it expression when you're standing on a stage and you're Julius Malema and you dance and you sing some songs that one's not allowed to sing? Is it when you decide to show your disgust at a certain political party by burning a t-shirt of that party? Is it something else? The court has to decide what expression actually means. And to do that, it has to interpret the words. So that is what all courts have to do. And with constitutional law, it's particularly acute, because obviously many of the rights, when they are applied, have certain what I would call political consequences, or consequences for people. It's often controversial. So the courts often try and interpret these provisions and justify these interpretations in ways that show that what they are doing is not politics. Because I think judges, maybe rightly so, are often anxious in a constitutional system. They are anxious that they are going to be told what you are doing is just politics. You are declaring invalid acts of parliament, acts of the president, no harm. And when you do that, nobody gave you a mandate. Who elected you? We were elected by 12 million people. You were selected by some few politicians and appointed. Who the hell are you? So the judges are very careful and scared about not being seen to do politics. So what they do is they interpret the constitution in ways, and they justify that interpretation with a reference to objective criteria or criteria that are outside of their own personal experience or their personal beliefs, or so they say. Of course, we know secretly that it's not always so clear. That is why there are often big fights about who gets appointed to, say, the Constitutional Court. Because as any lawyer will tell you, the first thing you ask when you're going to argue your case is, who's the judge? Is it Dennis Davis? And if you are trying to fight some progressive cause, then you have a good chance of convincing the judge. Or is it somebody that is slightly more traditional in their thinking about legal matters? Oh my goodness, you're going to lose the case. So we know that is there, but we put it on to the side. That is a side point. What the judge is trying to do to try at least to make their judgments credible, to make their judgments believable as legal judgments, not as political interventions, is to say we're going to use criteria to interpret the Constitution, which must be interpreted, but which has not necessarily anything to do with our personal political commitment. So they use often very traditional mechanisms. So precedent is the most obvious. You go and look at what the court the courts that you are bound by has said in the past. And then you're going to interpret that and say, oh, that court 10 years ago said this, we are bound by that principle, so we're going to just apply it here. Of course, in the South African context, it's not always so easy with constitutional law because our Bill of Rights and our Constitution is only 20 years old. So often, especially in the first 10 or 15 years, it wasn't so easy to find a precedent. Often what the courts did, that they went to borrow somewhere else from another court in another jurisdiction. When you ask people what courts would they have borrowed from, they are often surprised that it is not the U.S. Supreme Court that the South African Constitutional Court has borrowed from most. It is the Canadian Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court, I think our judges felt, has become too conservative, some would say reactionary, because the presidents appoint them and the Republicans have been appointing many judges, and some of them are quite conservative, let's put it that way. So the Canadian Supreme Court, they're more progressive, so we borrowed a lot, including our jurisprudence on equality from the Canadian cases. You can of course also use the dictionary. That is usually a bit of a cop-out, it seems to me. Sometimes people go to the dictionary and say, this word can mean this if you use the Oxford English Dictionary. It's not always a very helpful, it seems to me, an incredible way of doing it because the context matters. And then, and this is really what this whole seminar series is about, in our case what the courts have done is to say, well, we are going to look at the history out of which the Constitution was born. And we are going to ask ourselves, what is it that the Constitution is trying to achieve in response to what happened in our own past, our South African past. And here the metaphor of the bridge often comes into play. Because in the interim constitution, remember there was a constitution for 2 years between 1994 and 1996, the interim constitution, before the final constitution was drafted by the Constitutional Assembly. In that constitution, in the post-amble, I think it's the only constitution in the world that had both a preamble and a post-amble. In the post-amble, it spoke about the constitution being a bridge between, on the one hand, the apartheid past and this wonderful human rights-based future where there will be accountability, justification, and so on and so on. So the court says if the constitution is a breach, and if we want to, then what we want to do is we want to see where the breach is coming from, so that we can know where it's going to. And so we have to determine what the constitution and what the past actually means. And there was a famous earlier case, not a constitutional court case, I can never spell that or pronounce that because it has too many Q's in it, but called Zuleni's case, where Justice Frydenman, who later became a judge on the constitutional court, he said, how you can think about this is really, you can ask, what is the mischief that our constitution wants to prevent from recurring? What is it that happened during apartheid? It was so bad that we never want to have repeated again. And if you know that, then you can understand what the constitutional text actually means. So it's looking back, looking at the history, and that history helps you to understand, okay, what is the purpose here? The purpose of this particular provision. If you know the purpose, you can know what the scope of that provision is, whether it must be applied in a certain place in a specific way. Okay. So, the Constitutional Court, in many judgments, like the one I quoted you are from, invokes the past. And of course, in sometimes the past is just about how the Constitution actually came into existence, through a process of negotiation, dialogue, give and take. So that kind of history, the history of negotiations, is sometimes invoked by the court in certain cases. But in most cases, and what we're really going to focus on, is the other kind of past, is how was this South Africa, how did the country look? What actually happened in the country? What laws were passed? What actions were taken by the government that we really at no cost want to repeat in the post-apartheid, in the democratic era? So the court often refers then to cases like the police did this, so the police came to people's doors in the middle of the night, they arrested people, they infringed on people's dignity and so on, in order to explain what the constitution is supposed to mean. And obviously, this version of the past, I think, is now, it's quite widely accepted as more or less correct. The fact, I think there are not that many people who are going to argue that before 1994, South Africa was a wonderful country for everybody who lived here. You do get some of them. I get them on my blog, commenting and claiming that things have really gone down since 1994, and then you have to remind people a little bit of what has happened in the meantime. What I often do with my students, I have a file there of old Mail and Guardians, it was still called the Weekly Mail, and I will take them out and show them certain headlines, and then the students, because one forgets when you're my age, that these students were, when they were born in 1990 or 1992, they can't even remember about these things. Then you show them a picture of the front page of the newspaper where everything is blacked out because the apartheid government during the state of emergency said, you can't report on anything that the police or the military do. And so what the newspaper did, it put black strips over all the parts that were legally had to be censored. Then the apartheid government banned the black strips, and then there were white spaces. And then the apartheid government banned the white spaces, and then the next week, and then I put that up, the students like that, a front page in which the newspaper said, we can't tell you what is going on in the country, but if you want to know, you can phone the ministers. Here are the telephone numbers.
We forget that.
Some people forget that. But there's a general understanding that things were not well. And that there was legally entrenched racial discrimination. I mean, in the Western Cape, from until the 1980s, there was a preferential policies in terms of who could be employed. Africans could not be employed here unless there was exceptional circumstances, and so forth and so forth. And that is the kind of things that the Constitutional Court often invokes. In many of the judgments, it invokes the past, the apartheid past, the discrimination, the abuse of power by the state, the infringement of people's personal dignity through the infringement of their rights, and so on. So, and it seems rather uncontroversial. Unless you're going to have, of course, a look firstly at what the historians write. And then you see historians actually say, well, this is maybe one story. It's a very credible story. We all really know it because, especially those of us who have lived through it, we know that it's sort of true. But you can also understand our history differently. You could see it not so much in race terms, but you could see it in terms of class exploitation. So if you're a Marxist historian, for example, you're going to say, well, apartheid, yes, of course it was race-based, but at the heart of it was really an exploitation by the capitalists, and they wanted cheap labor, and that's why the apartheid system worked very well for them. Or you can ask a feminist historian, going to say, well, this story about racial discrimination and exclusion, what is missing there completely is the voices of women who have been excluded. There is this magical story, this one story that we have about our past, and there are silences in that story. It's not that the story is untrue, it is just that it's not completely, that it's partly true, that it doesn't give the full picture. That there are also, so the argument would go, other things that happen, which we don't necessarily always invoke when we talk about the big story about what happened in South Africa before 1994. We don't always talk about how women were discriminated against. We don't always talk about how gay men and lesbians were discriminated against, or disabled people were discriminated against. We don't always maybe talk about the role that religion played in the Christian national system of education. It's one of my bugbears because I went to a very conservative Afrikaans school where the Christian nationalism was very strong and very stifling for any creativity. So the argument is that maybe we have to be a little bit careful about when we talk about the past. And that the courts also maybe should be a little bit more careful when they talk about the past. That they shouldn't only focus on one story, some people call it a master narrative, story that we know, all that is more or less is true, but that maybe doesn't tell us the full picture of what actually happened. Because if you go and read up a little bit about history and how history is written and understood in the past 30 or 40 years, you get to understand that the writing of history has been made, is more complex perhaps than people understand, has been problematized a bit. There is a saying that often history is written by those who are the victors. You know, the classic example that is often used is, what kind of history would we have been taught if the Nazis had won the Second World War? It would have perhaps have been a slightly different version of all the facts which we would have been given, with a different narrative, with a different main aim than the one we now take for granted. So there is a problem with history in that it looks very clear, it looks obvious because it deals with facts. But of course, and that is the argument that I have made in several articles that I've written, it is not so. These facts are selected facts. They are not the whole truth about what actually happened in the past. Because it's impossible for any historian to reflect every single action that happened in the past. You select, in the same way that newspapers today, you know, what is in the newspaper and what is not in the newspaper, it says a lot. There's a big story there. If I open the Cape Times, I know that I'm probably very seldom am I going to read about a poor person living in a rural area who has no, you know, who's black. Just because the newspaper has to select what they're going to report, they're going to do so based on their resources, on their point of view, how they see the world, and then they're going to select those parts. And everything they're going to report on might be accurate factually, but it doesn't actually tell us the whole story about what is happening in our country. Last year I went with the Archbishop to the Eastern Cape to go, and it's a very strange trip, but in any case we went to look at various schools. You see the situation in especially rural schools in the Eastern Cape and the lack of resources. And one reads about things like this, but you don't read about this particular school where there are no textbooks, where there are picketries. You read about it when the poor child tragically falls in and drowns in the latrine, as happened last week in Limpopo, but otherwise not really. But I'm going off on a tangent. I'm really wanting to say that it is not so easy, I think, to think about the history as one finely determined set of facts that everybody agree on. Because the facts we might agree on, but we might choose different facts to emphasize different things, and that might change the way we understand what happened in our past. So if you're a strong feminist, you're going to focus on how women were discriminated against during apartheid along with black people, then your story about our past is going to be different. And I would think if you're going to interpret the Constitution with that version, you're going to maybe interpret the provisions of the Constitution slightly differently and in a more tender, progressive way than not. So, of course there are also people, I spoke about that before, who really just deny what happened in the past. That one cannot accuse the South African Constitutional Court of. It tries very hard to present a comprehensive picture. Whether they always get it right, I'm not sure. I think sometimes they miss some of the nuance of how people lived, of the different kinds of indignity and oppression, because of that very strong story about apartheid and the focus on the apartheid indignity. But the apartheid government was also intolerant and authoritarian in other ways that are not always highlighted as much, but in any case. There are people who, of course, just deny that things were wrong in the past. I don't know why, but I get involved in arguments with people, and some people really, I'm often surprised about how people rewrite the history. Title of this whole three-lecture series comes from Ivita Mosena, the most famous white woman in Africa, South Wales, who said once, after the Truth and Reconciliation Commission had revealed the fact that there were police hit squads, and that the police hit squads had actually gone to torture and murder people. And then Evita said she went out into the plotagang, and the white people said, no, that didn't ever happen, we didn't know this. And so she said, oh, the future is certain, but the past is unpredictable. We always make the past to make ourselves feel better about who we are, what we did, what we didn't do. You know, if you now speak to many white people, we have all been part of the struggles. We have all been fighting the good fight. We have, none of us ever voted for the National Party. They rigged all those elections. There's always a problem with that. Okay. Now, having said all that, it is therefore, I think, a difficult and not always obvious strategy for the Constitutional Court to use the past and to invoke the past in that way. Because depending on what version you're going to have of the past, you're going to have another answer for what is the Constitution meaning today. So in a way, it's a shifting target. If you have a certain judge who has maybe a very specific view about what happened in the past, the South African history, focuses maybe, say it's Edwin Cameron, he says, well, yes, of course there was the horrible apartheid, we must never forget that, but there was also discrimination against gay men and lesbians. Then that judge might interpret the provisions of the Constitution slightly differently from another judge who focuses maybe more on economic exploitation or whatever the case might be. But be that as it may, the courts do this. They invoke the past all the time. And they do so, as I've said, firstly because they really are struggling with this thing that they are not wanting to be politicians. They're looking for something outside of themselves to justify their interpretation. And they're also wanting to make an argument for their interpretation of the Constitution that is going to be credible, that is going to give legitimacy to the rulings of the Constitutional Court. And in that sense, despite the fact that this maybe is a bit of a shifting target and it's not always so clear what we're referring to or what has happened in the past, I think it's not a bad thing. I think it's a good thing that the Constitutional Court invokes the past. It's my personal view. Because we have seared into our consciousness as a nation the indignities of the past. And the court often uses that to say, now remember, this happened before. And we never want it to happen again. And that is why we're interpreting this particular provision of the Constitution in this particular way. So there will be an interpretation, say, of the right to freedom of expression. And the court will say, yes, remember what our apartheid government did when they censored books, you know, there's the apocryphal story about how the census even banned the children's book Black Beauty because they thought it was some political tract. So I don't know if that is true or not. So we have to remember that so that it doesn't ever happen again. It is a very helpful way, I think, of thinking about the Constitution as a document that is really trying to that is really trying to do two things. Firstly, a document that very much asserts itself as being not an abstract set of principles or promises. It's a document that is being situated, that has to be interpreted and applied within the actual reality in which we live. I think what the court often does, it says, well, if we want to know how to interpret this document, we have to take into account the context. To know the context, we have to remember what happened, where we're coming from, what the political context is that brought us to this particular point. So often the Constitutional Court, for example, will note that because of what happened in the past, there are vast discrepancies in wealth between people in South Africa, based largely still on race. In socio-economic rights cases, the court often does that, in some other cases as well. So that is very important. It situates the Constitution in a specific context. And it says, when we interpret the Constitution, it's not an abstract academic exercise. It is actually an exercise in which we actually have to take into account where this document came from, how it emerged, and in what political and social context it is operating at the moment. But secondly, I think it's a very helpful tool because it does, I think, help to give legitimacy to the judgments of the Constitutional Court. Like that, the first paragraph of the judgment I quoted to you, you know now the court is going to declare invalid an act of parliament. So it's a profoundly political thing to do, to say to parliament, yes, you were elected, you passed that law, but we think the law is unconstitutional. But the court did so by invoking what happened in the 1970s in the township where the police would come. And in that way, it gives legitimacy to their interpretation. And it says, this constitution is responding to injustice, the injustices that we know about from our particular version of the thought. Now, the interesting thing is that, and I've written about this also, the court, of course, sometimes ignores the past when it suits them. and they don't necessarily invoke the past when the outcome that they want to achieve, this is my view, the judges, if they were not sitting together, would be cross with me, but when the outcome is one that is different, they sometimes just don't mention the constitutional context or the past. Or they present a very narrow interpretation of the past. So that happens. And for many people that is shocking, but the fact is that constitutional law, by any law really, it is not a science. It is not something where you put the facts into the computer and out on the other side always comes one answer. It cannot happen like that. Last year, the year before, President Jacob Zuma says, these judges, we can't really trust them very well because sometimes there's 11 judges on the Constitutional Court, then you have a majority opinion and a minority opinion. What is that? They can't even agree with themselves about what the Constitution means and how it must be applied. But this is how the law works. The law is, people have to interpret the law. People have to actually interpret it, words that are often open-ended, as I said in the beginning. And people, judges, we cannot deny that they have their own personal commitments, their own emotional commitments, their own views, which they try to, as far as possible, keep out of things, but I don't think it's always possible to do so. And in that context, using the history, I think, helps a bit with the legitimacy, helps a little bit to give some stability to what the judges do, and helps to get the judges to think from a specific perspective about what the Constitution is all about. So that more or less, it's not always going to be precise, there's going to be different judges having different opinions, but more or less there's a certain kind of way of thinking about Constitution and the Bill of Rights especially that then emerges. And that helps because it also helps us to predict what the court will do in specific cases. So I always get phoned by newspapers, journalists who are very lazy. There are not too many here. And then I want to know, so who's going to win this case? I hate that question because I don't want to be wrong. But often I know who's going to win the case, even though I wasn't even where the arguments were done. Why? Because the court has now set in place this idea that When you understand the Constitution, you understand it with reference to what are we trying to get away from, where are we trying to go to, and that sort of context is one that helps to give some structure to what otherwise would be a very much a free-for-all, with each judge deciding according to the critical legal studies people. Well, they will decide the case and judge in the, depending on what they have for breakfast in the morning. We are not there because we have these kind of meaning-giving stories about the Constitution, what it means, how it is embedded in the past. And that's very helpful. I often quote to my students, see, I'm now I'm borrowing from my lectures to hear the same joke, so it's sometimes maybe boring, but luckily few of you look as if you've been in my class. from the famous, well, maybe it's not such a famous, Australian movie called The Castle. I don't know if you've seen it.
Yeah.
Yes. It's very funny. The Australian dry humor about a working class family living next to the airport, and then they're going to be, their house is going to be expropriated. And they're outraged because a house is more than just bricks and mortar, is your castle. And so they get their very bad lawyer to go and argue the case for them in a high court. And the lawyer doesn't really know anything about the law, but especially not about constitutional law, so he just says, it's unconstitutional to just throw these people out. And then the judge says, yes, but what section of the Constitution? And then the lawyer is humming and eyeing, and then finally, he comes up and he says, oh, it's the vibe of the Constitution. So, what I've spoken about tonight is really what I see as the vibe of the Constitution. How the court sees the vibe of the Constitution as something that is responding to what has happened in the past. And that way, if you know that vibe of the Constitution, if you know that that is the kind of thinking with which the Constitutional Court approaches any interpretation, it becomes a little bit easier to predict how it will come out. It doesn't always work. And as we will see, maybe reasonable people can differ about this. But this has a profound influence, it seems to me, on the way in which the Constitutional Court interpret section 9 of the Constitution, the section that guarantees equality, that prohibits unfair discrimination, and that mandates redress measures. And if you see the whole jurisprudence of the Constitutional Court about equality, it is embedded in this vibe of what happened in the past, what are the consequences we're still sitting with from the past that we have to address, but also what is it that we don't want to repeat under any circumstances. So tomorrow what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit generally about the approach of the Constitutional Court to equality and non-discrimination and make those links and try and show you how, when it approaches a matter, it tries and balances the various interests. The interest of looking, we don't want to repeat a race-obsessed society as we had under apartheid, but we also, because of our past, we're sitting with inequality, we're sitting with continued forms of discrimination, and how are we going to address that? But that I will do tomorrow, then on Friday, Wednesday, I will talk very specifically about affirmative action. But I've been told I must speak for 45 minutes and then I must give you an opportunity to ask some questions. So I think we are now at that point in the lecture. So any questions? Yes.
Has the vibe of the Constitutional Court changed given the fact that we've had a couple of Chief Justices,
yes,
and there have been changes in the composition,
yes,
of the judges of the Constitutional Court?
Yes, of course, they are always going to be different because different personalities change slightly the way in which the court operates. So I'll give you an answer in two ways. the court has become less, there's less consensus on the constitutional court than there was, say, under the first court, on the Arthur Chaskalson. He was a very forceful character and very convincing, and he often convinced different people to come together. It was his style to come together and try and get a compromise, and then to have one judgment which all 11 judges signed on to. In that era, they even once or twice, with a very politically delicate case, they didn't even put the name of the judge who wrote the judgment there. They just said the court. Like the judgment on the treatment action campaign about the HIV at the time when that was very politically big hot potato, they just wrote the court. Now there's far more disagreement between the judges, which results in more minority judgments. Almost every judge now, well, a sizable number of the judgments now have minority judgments. Often a split, 7 judges to 3 judges. Whether the constitutional court judges fundamentally now see the vibe of the constitution differently, I doubt it. Because there is that thing that you are also inducted into the culture of the court and the jurisprudence of the court. So there's jurisprudence and there's the precedent from the previous cases. And when you are there with all the other judges in that culture, where people sit around the table, they argue with one another, the sort of the values rub off on each other, you know? So, from my perspective, here and there, there's maybe one judgment that I thought, shoot, that he is slightly less progressive than I'm used to, especially minority judgment. But as a general rule, the court is more or less on the same political wavelength, if you will, than it was in 1994. That is at least my assessment. It might change over time. It's like the US Supreme Court in the 1970s, it was very progressive. Now it is really quite conservative. But unlike the US Supreme Court, where we know that 4 of the judges are right-wing, 4 of the judges are the progressive, and Judge Kennedy is in the middle, and all the lawyers only argue to convince him. In our court, it doesn't work like that. Yes.
2 questions. We have a Bill of Rights. Why don't we have a Bill of Responsibilities? Yes. The word responsibility does not appear anywhere in the Bill of Rights. Secondly, if people understood that we have a system of proportional representation, how did the Constitutional Court allow floor crossing, which completely destroyed the concept of proportional representation?
The first one, the Bill of Responsibilities, well, that is not in the tradition of any human rights documents. Interestingly enough, the closest that any human rights documents come to listing a list of responsibilities is the African Charter of Human and People's Rights. I would argue that the Bill of Rights, implicit in the rights, are responsibilities. Because if a person has a right, and especially our Bill of Rights, which applies not only to against the state, it is also, in most cases, applies between people. That means if your fellow human beings have rights, you have responsibility to respect those rights. Of course, as with many things, the devil is in the detail of how that actually is enforced in practice. It's not always easy to enforce. But rights implies responsibilities, because if you have rights, other people have responsibilities to respect your rights.
That's how I would accept it.
Yeah.
Is it going to work for the DA March?
Well, that has to do with, of course,
for 17.
You need the police, of course, to be impartial and to interfere or intervene and protect people's constitutional rights as required. Let me not go any further. Let me just say something about the floor crossing. The Constitutional Court was vehemently criticized for allowing floor crossing. The fact of the matter is, the people who argue that floor crossing was unconstitutional couldn't actually invoke any specific bill of the right in the Bill of Rights to say this right is being taken away. They invoked Section 1 of the Constitution, which says there are general values, and the court said, well, these are values, we cannot actually test legislation against these values. And the court had a specific, I think they've changed their opinion, and you'll be happy to hear that in the meantime, they had a very specific idea of democracy. They said, well, people vote. People vote for the parties. The parties, including the DA and the ANC, voted for floor crossing. And we don't see any right being actually interfered with. And if people don't like this, they must make their voices heard at the next election. Now the court is a little bit more, I think, slowly moving to a position where they see they have to protect the democracy. But that argument didn't fly. And that is where the court, I think, the best criticism of the court about floor crossing is that the court didn't see that it has a role not only in protecting the individual rights, but to make sure that the framework within which the democracy can operate, that framework remains in place. And they didn't really see the bigger picture. Some would say it's also, you know, it's a separation of powers. They were a little bit nervous about interfering, especially, as I said in the judgment, because 90 or 85% of the people in Parliament voted for that floor crossing, rightly or wrongly. Another question at the back. Yes, they're not with you. Yeah.
My question is about, well, the vibe.
Yeah.
The vibe comes from the bomb steps, really.
Yes.
And so I'm interested in that form of practice, if you will, of what is the social practice in the court, or the cultural norms or the methods, really, and how that is different to what had preceded it.
Yes. Well, we come from a very formalistic legal culture. A very formalistic legal culture in which judges in apartheid years often said, well, we just look at what the law says, the provisions of the law, we apply them. We don't want to know what happens there, you know, are people going to be taken in the middle of the night out of their beds and tortured? We don't want to know about that. We apply the law, and we formally apply the law, and we assume that the law can formally be applied. The Constitutional Court has introduced far more of a far less formalistic way of reasoning, of engaging with legal questions, and some people criticize them for that, but they are far more concerned about the impact of their decisions on ordinary people. So if you go to the Constitutional Court and you hear arguments, it's always surprising that often a lot of the argument in the court is not about the principle, is there a rights infringement or not. The court says, okay, so there is a rights infringement. If we now rule for you, what's going to happen? Is there going to be chaos? Can say the e-tolling. If we now stop e-tolling, 20 billion loan that Sunderland has taken out for whatever reason, you know, what are the consequences going to be? We're not in treasury. Can we really make that order? Maybe not this time. So the court is very concerned about the consequences of their judgments. Far more, I think, than in the more formalistic tradition, which is a profound shift in kind of legal reasoning.
I wonder if you can have any time to talk about the advantages and disadvantages of the voting system, because I see a very good voting system, but I see flaws in it.
Yes.
In particular, the way the parties construct a party list.
Yes.
Gives an immense power to the chief executive of the party.
Oh, you know, it's very funny because I have, just before I came here, finished writing for my blog a piece about exactly that. That there are two, I can't, it's a bit off topic, but there are two issues really. The one is the electoral system, which give party bosses a lot of power, because you are only in parliament because you are on a list, that you are put on the list by the party, and you are accountable to the party, not to the people. But secondly, even if you change it to constituencies, or you have multi-member constituencies, as Hassan Slabbert said, and you don't change the way in which parties select the candidates, I'm not sure it's going to change much, because many of the constituencies are not going to be competitive. I would go out in a limb and think that in Constantia and the Rosebank and the CBD, the ANC is not going to win an election in a constituency. And the DA is not going to win a constituency in Khayelitsha, not in the foreseeable future. Then, once again, you're the party candidate, so the real election happens when you are selected for that constituency. And who does that? Is there democracy in there? Maybe not. The big problem is, how do you make it more democratic without allowing the influence of money to come in? Because if you have, in the US, they have primaries, so people must get money from various sources, various companies, and before you know it, you know, the developer wants to develop the Seapoint Promenade, they give money to the person there to run the primary campaign, and before you know it, they voted to build a 20-story hotel there on the promenade. So you want to be a little bit careful. I don't know, that's one of that, to think about how can you make it more democratic without corrupting the process indifferently. Yes.
If you could say something about the dangers, or what I believe are the dangers of reactivity, because so much of the same, the mischief of the past has been identified, it was all wrong.
Yeah.
So the assumption that there's anger and dismissal and we must make it, it was wrong, we must make it right, which is to me an alarmingly simplistic notion. Not to mention all the ideas about who interprets so-called facts. Okay. So I'm really struggling with this.
Well, we're going to talk about that in the next 2 days. I'm going to try and convince you that it is actually important to think about the past in that way, and to think about how we address the effects of the past. If we want the constitutional project to work, just if you just think not in terms of ethics, but you just think of practicalities and purely self-interest, I think there's something for that. But can I leave your question for the next 2 days? We're going to talk about that, and if I don't answer it in any way, please come back to me. A last question, yes.
I guess all courts rely upon precedent.
Yes.
What you're saying, you give me the picture that this court relies more than most on history. How does that mean that they don't continually solve today's problems by refighting yesterday's battles?
Yes. Well, firstly, of course, the court, when it started, there was no precedent. The only precedent was from the apartheid era, so you couldn't really. There was no constitutional supremacy. The courts couldn't declare valid acts of parliament or the executive. So there wasn't precedent. So they had to create the precedent. And they often created the precedent by saying, what is this constitution trying to achieve? Where is it the bridge? Where is it trying to take us? But if you, and that is why it's a bit subtle in the sense that it is not only about the past. It's about where are we coming from? Where do we want to go? What is the promise of the constitution given what has happened in the past? So it's not just the one or the other. It is looking back, but then looking forward and saying, given where we're coming from, given this history, where do we think this constitution is trying to take us? So it's the court, we will see when we talk about affirmative action, for example. The court tries, and philosophers will say, play with both hands. It's trying to say, look where we're coming from, we have to in some way address the effects. But we also want to do it in a way that is going to create a better South Africa and a better society. And These things are very difficult. I think I'm sometimes very happy that I'm not the judge of the Constitutional Court, because it's things to grapple with. There are 50 million people in South Africa. Many of us are very angry. Many white people are very angry. Many black people are very angry. The court is trying to use the Constitution to solve these problems as best they can, but of course, the court is not the body that actually solves political problems. It's the political processes that you say. And I think there's another discussion to be had about how we often rely too much on courts to solve what are essentially political disputes. But that's another matter. In any case, that is my talk for tonight. I'll see you tomorrow night at 7:30.